This is episode number 11 of Tech Policy Weekly from the Technology Liberation Front for Thursday, May 3rd, 2007. I'm Jerry Brito of the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. Up for discussion this week, the Supreme Court does patents, it smacks down the Federal Circuit in KSR versus Teleflex, and Microsoft prevails over AT&T in another important patent case. Plus, what's the latest on the Vonage versus Verizon patent saga? And is Dig in hot water over the posted AACS encryption key? Joining me to discuss these topics are Tech Liberation Front contributors, starting with Braden Cox of the Association for Competitive Technology. Hey, Braden.
Hey, guys. How's everyone going?
Doing pretty well. Got Hans Haney of the Discovery Institute.
Glad to be here.
Hey, Hans. And Tim Lee of the Cato Institute.
Hey, Jerry.
Hey, Tim. Our guest this week is Ben Clemens of the Brookings Institution. Glad to have you with us, Ben.
Good to be here.
All right. Well, first up, the Supreme Court does patents. Ben, tell us a little bit about the Teleflex case and especially what the Supreme Court did here with the Federal Circuit.
Sure. But, well, perhaps we should begin by describing the conflict over the last year or two between the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit and the Supreme Court. So the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit was founded in the 80s as the Supreme Court of patent cases. And the Supreme Court has left them to do this. So you've got a couple of people on the CAFC who do nothing but hear patent cases all day long. And, of course, the natural candidate for such a judge is a former patent attorney, right? So the CAFC has basically become a court that interprets patent law by patent attorneys for patent attorneys. And since the 80s, they've expanded the scope of patent law in four ways, all of which have been very favorable toward patent holders. They've made it easier to get damages from infringement on a patent. They've changed the definition of obviousness. They've expanded the scope of patents to the international sphere, and they've basically eliminated subject matter restrictions, so anything is patentable.
Hey, Ben, a question out of left field for you. Is there any other comparable court like this that's basically a subject matter court where you have seen capture like this?
Well, there are a couple of specialist courts. For example, there's an international trade court, and the Federal Circuit has a few other little niches. But this sort of capture, I believe, is basically unique to the CAFC. Hmm. And it's kind of amazing, because normally you don't let a court write its own jurisdiction, and this is almost what the CAFC has been allowed to do, partly because the Supreme Court has been laissez-faire about it and has let them have free rein for a decade and a half. And about 2 years ago, they decided, okay, we've had enough. And last year we saw eBay, which shut down the scope of preliminary injunctions that you could get on a patent. And then we've got our two cases today. And KSR was the case that got rid of the limited scope of what a person can determine to be obvious. It's a problem for a patent attorney. Let's say you have a client who comes in and says, I've got this idea, and you as an attorney want to be able to tell them, this will or won't get through the patent office. And if there's something subjective like obviousness in play, then you can't tell them, right? So the CAFC tried to eliminate any sort of subjective issues here. And what they came up with was saying, if it's in the literature, if we can find a prior reference, then it's obvious. If we can't find a prior reference, then it's not obvious. And in this case, we have the combination of two existing elements. There's a gas pedal that's adjustable, so you don't have to move your seat back and forth. And there's a certain placement of an electronic sensor. And this combination was patented because it did not exist in the literature. There was no teaching, suggestion, or motivation in the literature. And then somebody else, across town happened to, have a sensor in his shop and an adjustable gas pedal and said, hey, wait, I can put these two together. And so this went through the Supreme Court, and the question was, do we need such a strict, definite teaching suggestion or motivation in the literature before we can say something is obvious? And the Supreme Court said, no, this is far too strict. To quote from the ruling, a person of ordinary skill is also a person of ordinary creativity, not an automaton. And so that's what we saw today. We saw a return to an older standard where there's some subjectivity and, you know, some humanity in what is obvious.
I thought the striking thing about the decision was the number of times the Supreme Court used the phrase common sense. I think it was three or four times. I mean, the message just seemed to be that, you know, come on, you can't just that there has to be some exercise of independent judgment. You can't strictly boil down obviousness to a question of prior art.
You know, yeah, I want to refer to the Court of Appeals, too, because we've trashed the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit on a couple of occasions now in previous podcasts. But, you know, the fact is they were created to bring some uniformity and predictability to patent enforcement. And so, unsurprisingly, I think they eventually arrive at these formalistic conceptions, which is what the Supreme Court complained about, because obviously formalistic conceptions invite calculation and abuse. And
well, there are two critiques to that. The first is there's some question as to whether they've really brought that standardization. You may know there's still venue shopping. There are still places, the Eastern District of Texas and a certain district in Michigan are famous for this, for being very pro-patent, whereas other places are not so pro-patent. And second, somehow all of these objective standards have been in the favor of patent holders. And there's no ex ante reason to expect this, because a patent attorney is going to be, defending against a patent as often as they're going to be prosecuting a patent. But we've seen over and over again that these standards have always been a watering down. And when there was a question of subjectivity, they say, no, forget it. We'll just eliminate this test.
I think this KSR decision is actually very important for the software industry. If there's going to be such a thing as software patents, I think this decision really allows and gives the PTO the ability to strike down patents that aren't worthy of having patent or inventions aren't worthy of having patent protection, and which really gives gives some good light on those that are worthy and new and useful and non-obvious. We need to really be focusing on those that deserve to be compensated. Unfortunately, a lot of because of the patent standards in the PTO right now, we're seeing too many bad patents.
Now, there's an open question about how many obvious patents we're going to be able to eliminate with KSR, mm-hmm. because the specific wording and the question of the case was about a combination of elements that said, well, you've got an adjustable gas pedal, you've got an electronic sensor, is putting the two together obvious or not? And there's still debate about this, and we're going to have to wait to see how cases work out. But there are a large number of patents that can be characterized as a combination of two elements, but a large number that are more complex than that. And it's an open question that's being debated by patent pundits everywhere, whether this is going to be applicable to those cases or not.
The Wall Street Journal claimed this morning in an editorial that our libertarian friends who argue because property rights are good and a patent is a kind of property right, then all patents must be good. I don't think any of us are arguing that at all. I just want to say before we leave KSR versus Teleflex, I think this was absolutely the correct decision. I'm very pleased with it. I think we can all agree that strong protection is needed for good patents, but not for bad patents.
Braden, why don't you tell us about the other patent case, Microsoft versus AT&T, which the Supreme Court just decided.
Sure. Just like I think KSR kind of adds a duh test to the examination process, I think that AT&T Microsoft does that as well. And the fact is that this was about a case where the original case that was precedent was called referred to as the Deep South case. And this was a shrimp deveining company that, in order to avoid restrictions here in the United States, sold things as components and then shipped them overseas and let the overseas recipient combine them together. And because of the some say loopholes in the patent law here and the combination rule section 271F, the company was trying to avoid U.S. jurisdiction. Well, this Deep South rule was enshrined into law, but what happens when we have a software product that's not like a mechanical device like a shrimp deveiner? Well, I think we have another common sense decision here too, where essentially the court said software is not like a shrimp deveiner, and the Golden Master CD, this one CD that was sent from the USA to Germany, is not a component in the sense that what it was trying to somehow remove itself from U.S. jurisdiction. And the court essentially said here that AT&T, if you have any problems with patent infringements and would like to sue in this area, then you have to sue in Germany, I think is where the jurisdiction was, and not in the U.S. courts because the courts don't have jurisdiction here.
Yeah, the interesting thing about that was that it wasn't just whether or not the Golden Master was patentable, but the question was whether the copies that were made from the Golden Master, one, could be counted as a component, and then two, were they supplied from the United States? Mm-hmm. And the position AT&T took was just that the software in the abstract is the component, and so it doesn't matter whether you're making copies or not. It's just if the software came from Microsoft, it was supplied by Microsoft. And the court said, no, that if you're making a copy of the software, the copy is a new component, and that component was supplied by the overseas manufacturer. And it seems to me that's an interesting stance just because it suggests that it raises the question about whether intangible ideas, the extent to which those are eligible for patent protection, which is not a subject that the Supreme Court dealt with directly, but it does, I think, hint at the idea that what patent really should be covering is physical objects rather than abstract ideas.
I think they were right to avoid that question, though, because this was specifically an international trade question, and our Supremes are trained to not make too many comments about side issues in a ruling.
Sure, I think that's right, but I think it also, but it's something that was left, I think, deliberately open and probably justifiably so. But it seems like something that the Supreme Court might revisit in the future to more directly ought this to have been patentable in the first place?
Well, one thing that didn't make the headlines was a case that got thrown out, LabCorp v. Metabolite, which I don't know, you guys may or may not be familiar with, which specifically addressed the question of what is patentable subject matter. And the court heard the case, they gathered all the briefs, but in the last minute decided not to put out a ruling on the case due to technical issues. And we're waiting for a substitute for that case. And Justice Breyer especially expressed a real desire to put out a case like that. So keep your eyes open. I think we're likely to see something in the near future that directly addresses that question.
One last question before we move on. So is there a definite shift into Roberts Court? If so, why? And what does that mean?
Well, it is interesting. I think you've seen, both in the oral arguments and in the decision, I think you saw maybe more skepticism of the Federal Circuit. Justice Roberts had a sort of derisive comment about, the fact that the patent bar is all on one side of the case just, demonstrate that it's good for the patent bar. And I think Judge Alito was in the Microsoft v. ATT case, he was signed on to a concurrence along with Justice Breyer that was, I think, the most vociferously critical of the Federal Circuit. So I think, I'm not sure why, but it seems like the younger members of the court might be more skeptical of the Federal Circuit than the older ones.
And I do think we will see more patent cases in the future. The court has seen a number of patent cases now in just the past few years, and I think that reflects the kind of the uncertain nature of patents with information technology and software. But I also think that it does reflect just a much-needed relook and even a revamp of kind of the patent system and probably reflects a little bit of the reason why Congress needs to get working and moving on reform issues. I think if they had done this earlier, we wouldn't be seeing these type of cases as much.
All right. Well, next up, we're going to talk about the latest on the Vonage Verizon patent spat. Tim, you've been following this closely. What's going on?
Well, there's been three major developments since we talked about this, I think, 3 weeks ago. One is Verizon got the stay they were looking for from the Federal Circuit. The district court had handed down an order that down and stop signing up new customers. And I think if that had stood, even for the few months it'll take for the appeal to happen, it could easily have driven Vonage into bankruptcy because they're relying on signing up a lot of new subscribers in order to achieve profitability, which they haven't done yet. The second thing that happened was that they, the day after the Teleflex decision, they filed a request for reconsideration of the decision based on the Teleflex precedent. And I think that in particular there's three patents, two of which are almost identical. But one of them is one of the patents covered the concept of connecting to a VoIP network with a wireless device. And I think it's really a classic Teleflex style, because in the patent it discloses that people had previously made wireless phone calls and they had previously made phone calls over the internet, and all the patent really covered was a device that can make phone calls over the internet wirelessly. And so I think that one in particular will be very vulnerable to a challenge either at the district court or before the Federal Circuit. And then the third thing that Vonage just did, it has sort of taken its case to the Court of Public Opinion and is asking, I set up a website, I think, called freetocompete.org, something like that. And they're hoping to rally public support for the idea that there should be competition in the VoIP market.
I just have one thought. I mean, this is an example of the application of a previous Supreme Court precedent, the eBay versus Market Exchange, which said that if you're going to request a permanent injunction, the traditional four-factor test applies, and that includes a consideration of whether there are other damages that are likely to be adequate, the impact on the public and the economy, you know, and so forth. And so that's probably the reason why Vonage is being allowed to continue to sign up customers. So I think that is, a positive outcome of the Supreme Court's renewed interest in this area. And again, I would just make the point that this really raises the question whether Congress ought to be considering fundamental patent reform at all.
On top of the fact that eBay v. Merck Exchange gave the CAFC a way of halting this preliminary injunction, I think bad press helped as well. We can go back to the BlackBerry case, which was the worst press the patent industry has ever had, the patent system has ever had last year. At the last minute, some of the key patents were actually invalidated by the USPTO, and one patent attorney described the situation as the USPTO taking the patents out back and beating them with rubber hoses. they had so violated every rule that they had put together, and clearly this was because of bad press. They felt embattled, and they felt we need to show that we're good players and we're not a block to the progress of the science and useful arts. And I get the feeling that to some extent, and this is unsubstantiable because I can't read minds, that was part of the consideration here in allowing Vonage to continue its business.
Tim, how's Vonage doing from a business sense? I mean, I think they lost their CEO, is that right?
Yes, they did. I think that was 3 or 4 weeks ago now, they lost their CEO, and I think they said that this isn't related to the patent issue, but obviously it can't have helped. And so yeah, there has been talk about bankruptcy. I don't think that they're I think that if they don't lose this patent case, they're not in imminent danger of that. But certainly they're a struggling competitor, largely I think because of all the regulatory and patent roadblocks that the telecom incumbents have put up. One other thing I wanted just to point out with regard to what Ben was saying is I think you see the Federal Circuit doing the same sort of thing. Even before Teleflex was handed down, the Federal Circuit handed down some decisions that, and I think there was even a footnote in the Supreme Court decision noting this, that were more flexible in their application of the teaching suggestion and motivation test than they had been before the Supreme Court accepted Teleflex. So I really do think that the people who are part of the patent system, in a sense, are very worried about either the public or Congress or the Supreme Court making dramatic changes, and they're hoping to make smaller changes to forestall any precipitous changes.
All right. Well, finally, we're going to talk about DIG, which is a flutter with the posting of the AACS encryption key. Tim, I'm going to go back to you since you know a little bit about this. What's going on with DIG?
This was a really interesting incident that actually gave me a little bit of nostalgia for the for my college days. So there's a new HD DVD and Blu-ray format that has this encryption format called AACS. And a few months ago, some hackers managed to find security flaws in this copy protection, as always happens with copy protection systems.
Inevitably.
And one of the things that they extracted was this key that's useful to unscrambling pretty much any AACS encrypted content, at least prior to the point where they cracked it. And so this key had been released. It had been sort of circulating around geeky websites, but fairly low profile. And then last month, the organization that administers the AACS began sending out cease and desist letters demanding the websites remove this key. And I should mention, this key is a 16-byte number. It's basically a very long integer. And so various websites had this. They got cease and desist letters. And one of the sites that got one of these cease and desist letters on Tuesday was Dig, which is a Web 2.0 site where all the stories are chosen by the votes of the users. And when Dig removed one of these stories, word sort of got around among the Dig user base, and all of them began submitting more stories with this key and voting them up to the front page. And I believe at one point, the entire front page was full of stories about this key. And this just seems really interesting to me, because it's a case where the people who run Dig really only had two options. They could allow this key on their front page, or they could shut their website down, and it's a multi-million dollar for business. So as a practical matter, shutting their website down wasn't really an option. And so this key is now famous. There's absolutely nothing that can be done to get it out of the public eye now.
Tim, what law is being violated by this key being published?
The argument, I believe, is that it violates the DMCA's anti-circumvention provisions, because the DMCA prohibits distributing circumvention devices or parts of a circumvention device. And the argument is that this key, the only legitimate or the only use for it would be to use it as part of a software to crack encryption on DVDs. It's not clear whether that argument would fly in court, because it is just a long number. But I think that is their argument, and there's at least a plausible case that they would win.
And of course, Dig. I mean, anyway, Dig is being set up to make a First Amendment free speech case in the event that they are sued, aren't they?
Yeah, I don't know actually what legal argument they would make, because I mean, I think they also might be able to make an argument that they just didn't have any choice, that that they were that the key would have ended up on their website pretty much whatever they were doing, and that it appeared lots of other places. I don't know if that how that sort of argument would fly in court, but I mean, there really wasn't anything that the Dig's founders could do, so they might be able to come up with some sort of legal argument to that effect.
I mean, I know that every geek in cyberspace is going to be wearing a T-shirt within a week with his key on it. So.
To me, it's
a free speech argument.
And this is part of the reason that I say this gives me nostalgia for college, because this is a exact repeat of the DCSS battle circa 2000-2001, and you had the same sort of thing. People were writing songs about the DCSS code. They were selling T-shirts with it on it, and I think it took 4 years before a court ruled that, given all the attention this has received, this is no longer a trade secret, and so we're not going to try to stop people from distributing it.
Hans, you were going to say something?
Well, thanks. I mean, to me, this implies that notice and takedown maybe doesn't work. And Viacom, in its complaint against Google, made kind of a similar argument. They argued, for example, that Google's copyright protection tools on the YouTube site, which apparently now prevent you from uploading the exact same video or segment of a video after YouTube receives a takedown notice. So Viacom is arguing that that's inadequate, because a user can alter as little as a frame or two of a video and then repost it, whereupon the copyright holder has to file a new takedown notice. So, in effect, it's unworkable, and they make some other allegations as well related to this. But what's the alternative? If notice and takedown doesn't work, you know, during the DMCA debate, the choice was, the question was between should we have surveillance by carriers and ISPs, or can we have something less intrusive and less onerous for everyone, this notice of takedown? So this worries me that this could lead to, you know, chilling content on the internet.
But I think it's pretty clear that the surveillance alternative wouldn't have worked any better. I mean, the you know, it's not that DIG was ignoring these takedown notices, or I mean, they tried for several hours to remove the notices as or remove the stories as they were posted. They were just posted too fast, and it just would have been. I mean, I guess they could have, you know, if they'd had a few days to prepare, they might have been able to change their software so it like automatically detected these keys and rejected the stories. But the problem is just it's a logistical problem where a company that only has a handful of staff members simply can't compete with millions of people who are you know, passing this key around. And so I'm not sure. I mean, I think the long-term answer is that it just isn't possible to prevent sufficiently determined users to exchange information they want to exchange. And that's unfortunate for supporters of copyright, myself included. But I'm not sure. I mean, you know, I'm not sure there really is any way to prevent it.
All right. Well, so, go ahead, Ben.
Oh, I just have a question for you guys. So the DMCA totally has egg on its face right now. Do any of you think this is going to lead to actual reform, that anyone in Congress is taking notice of this?
Well, I'm not sure what the reform would be. I mean, obviously, my preferred reform would be to, you know, repeal the law entirely. But short of that, I mean, I'm not sure. And I don't think there's the support in Congress for that. I'm not sure how you would change the DMCA to make it to more effectively control this or to draw a better line. My guess is probably Congress won't do anything with this because they won't really have any idea what to do with it.
Hopefully they wouldn't come up with a strict or absolute liability regime, you know, applicable to anyone whose fingers touch, you know, the effect of the copyrighted material. I mean, it's easy to imagine some extremely onerous solutions to this, and I'm sure that there will be people advocating that.
Yeah. Brad?
Well, yeah, I just wanted to say I think I share the concerns of both Hans and Tim, or at least agree with Tim in the sense I don't think this is going to lead to anything wholesale in Congress. It's a rather minor issue in the big scheme of things of what they're considering right now. But and Hans, I worry too what will happen if this notice and takedown doesn't work, because I think that's actually overall a pretty good bargain that we have. You know, the DMCA is all about compromise. So I think, you know, that's hopefully we don't get anything worse in trying to compromise with this.
Well, I just wanted to say it's worth notice that this was not a notice and takedown case. Notice and takedown is for copyright infringement, and the AACS's argument was an anti-circumvention complaint. So it's not clear that I don't think the notice and takedown provisions apply, and it's not clear whether ISPs can be held liable, that they have the safe harbor available. So it's not clear what the courts will do if they do decide to sue DIG.
All right, well, we'll keep an eye on that. Well, that's going to have to do it for Tech Policy Weekly this time. Thanks to Brad Cox, Hans Haney, Tim Lee, and Ben Clemens. Thank you, guys.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
To read more commentary from our panelists and the rest of the Technology Liberation Front gang, visit us at techliberation.com. Also, if you have something to say about something we said, you can post a comment on the website. Just go to techliberation.com/podcast, and you can leave a comment on the page for this show. If you'd like what you heard, please tell a friend. Please review the show on iTunes, and don't forget to dig our podcast. Until next week, I'm Jerry Brito. Goodbye.
Seven, four.